Welcome to One Bite is Everything, the podcast where we explore how the food choices you make can have a big impact on your health, your community, and the planet. I am your faithful host, Dana DePrima, and today I am pleased to be joined by Jonathan Coppice, an associate professor and the director of the Gardner Agricultural Policy Program at the University of Illinois. Jonathan brings a wealth of knowledge and insight into agricultural policy and its far-reaching implications. Since One Bite is Everything's mission is to empower you with key takeaways and actionable insights, today's episode promises to be particularly enlightening. We'll dive into the belly of our agricultural policies, particularly the Farm Bill, and how they shape the way we grow and consume our food, and how these policies connect to our health, the environment, our communities, and the economy. Jonathan will guide us through the complex history of the Farm Bill, a piece of legislation that has been evolving for over 90 years since its roots in the New Deal era. He'll help us understand its historical context. Key updates include increased funding for conservation programs and new initiatives such as the Feral Swine Eradication and Control Pilot Program, doubling of funding for the Market Access Program, otherwise known as MAP, and the Foreign Market Development, FMD, program to boost U.S. food and agricultural exports. Also, enhanced oversight and expanded eligibility for SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, along with new provisions to streamline access and improve program integrity. The bill faces a challenging political landscape with debates over funding allocations and prioritization of various programs. The Senate will play a crucial role in shaping the final version of the bill. The debates and decisions made around this bill will influence not only the agriculture sector, but also broader issues such as national security, food security, and economic stability. Throughout our conversation, we'll explore the intricate balance of supporting farmers, promoting conservation, and ensuring that our agricultural policies meet the modern challenges of a changing climate and evolving food systems. Jonathan's insights will provide you with a deeper understanding of how policy shapes our food landscape and what you can do to advocate for a more sustainable and equitable food system. So, get ready to gain a perspective on the food you eat, its journey from farm to table, and the policies that impact it all. This episode is packed with valuable information and practical steps you can take to get closer to your food and make informed choices that benefit your health, your community, and the planet.
So the Farm Bill, we've been at this for 90 years. 90 years of efforts in this direction, right? Where we provide direct assistance to farmers. So that means we're rooted in the New Deal, we're rooted in the Great Depression kind of thing. So there's a key historical baggage that comes with that. Like, you know, every time we talk about a Farm Bill, we're not starting on a clean slate. We're starting with a pretty hefty amount of historical baggage around this, and that can pull in any number of things. So I start with that. When I bore students with this, a couple of things I try to impress upon them: the importance of farm policy in terms of the food system, in terms of the environment, and, you know, the national security implications of being able to produce food for a growing society. And those are important. I also like to think that the Farm Bill is kind of a window into how Congress works or doesn't work, and sort of what do we can learn a lot because we've done so many iterations of this over 90 years through really key parts of history. That it also provides a lot of examples and learning and understanding about this sort of political development we've gone through as a country since that Great Depression. Right? Some pretty key stuff from the Depression to World War II to the Civil Rights Movement to the more modern set of issues. You know, lately I've been sort of delving deeper into climate change and some of the increasingly challenging issues in managing the risk of farming. We're watching another rainstorm roll through here in Illinois at what is becoming the key time to plant crops, right? And so looking ahead to the future, I see that as like the big issue on the horizon, not just climate change, but how we adapt or evolve or change or improve policies that work with farmers going into the teeth of the consequences of climate change. Like, these things are really, really going to get difficult. And moving that 90 years of historical baggage into a set of policies that adapt to that and can continue to adapt to help farmers, to me, is a huge challenge that, I mean, it's kind of exciting on one hand. It's also rather daunting and concerning on the other, when you particularly look at some of the lack of doing so over history.
I don't think that people realize the national security angle of a farm bill and of our nation's support of farmers in different ways.
So if we think about it, there's no faster path to chaos and societal upheaval than bread lines and food shortages. I mean, we are extraordinarily fortunate in this country. We've never ever really experienced that level of societal risk and upheaval from food shortages. I mean, we had rationing and some of that during World War II, but most of us have never lived through it. And in fact, we live in an era of just extraordinary abundance when it comes to food. And we got a lot of things to point to. Now, I also don't want to overstate that. One of our great problems and challenges right now is our increasing inability to manage nuance and complexity. And this is a very nuanced, complex, complicated set of issues. So I don't want to overstate the national security implications of this. You know, clearly paying direct subsidies to farmers a year after it on programs that don't actually have to plant crops for it, it's hard to say those things are directly connected. Crop insurance, much more connected, right? Helping farmers be able to weather the weather, to be able to get through the just unbelievable amount of risk that the growing season presents. So those things have real implications and real value. That doesn't mean our policies match it, right? So our policies may not meet the moment or the challenge, but I think driving some of the politics and the support or the interest in these is this background issue. And so sometimes I've called this like an insurance policy for society. And it may have a lot of challenges to it, but ultimately, at our best, we're trying to think through how we continue the food productive capability into the future. The subsidy question is a really difficult one. And again, it's the one that has the most historic baggage, right? So if you frame it a little bit in that concept, that the subsidies we have in place today are very legacy based, right? They started in 1933 as an emergency response in the Great Depression. And so there's a lot to that, right? There's a lot of challenges of that era, and we carry a lot of that through. We really just started helping corn, cotton, and wheat. I mean, there's a political reason, there's regional issues to that.
Explain a little bit more about those reasons.
It's a combination of just politics, right? So cotton, wheat, and corn represent our three major production regions. So cotton in the South, corn in the Midwest, wheat out in sort of the Western Plains. And so politically, right, those are where the members of the agricultural committees were from. And those were the farmers they heard from. And those were the farmers that had taken the hits, right? Particularly if you think wheat out West, we've expanded production to deal with World War I demand. And then that kind of fell off the cliff after the war. And so you see those things develop. And so politically, if you think in terms of the factional political interest, that's what builds up. The other side of it is the ability to use these bulk commodities that are storable or transportable and those sort of things that had open markets. So you could use some of those things to design programs. And then you had things like, if you're helping with wheat, you're helping with the food production side of that. So, right, wheat goes into bread and pastas, and how we do that has the food system implications. Most of the corn at the time was fed to livestock. In fact, at that time, very diversified farms. So a lot of that corn was either fed on the farm or with neighbors who were raising hogs and chickens and cows. And dairy was an initial part of this support system too, right? So you're looking like the sort of staple commodities, and you're trying to get into there to help, with some presumptions, questionable even then, that doing so would benefit throughout the food system. So I think that's a big part of it. But it is political, right? I mean, these are policies, and you can't decouple politics from this. So I think that's a big part of it at the beginning. And then that's carried through over time. My dad is retired from farming, but he'd always sort of joke about, like, really, farming is making mistakes and then trying again next year. And so farm bills are a lot of time. We're making mistakes and we're trying to deal with that, right? A good example is during World War II, we were subsidizing perishable commodities, potatoes, tomatoes, vegetable crops, right? And the way we did the programs then, you know, farmers would forfeit the commodity or forfeit the crop if prices were too low. Well, all of a sudden you've got the federal government holding like mountains of potatoes that were going rotten and had to be thrown out, right? So then, well, we're not going to subsidize those crops anymore because the logistics and the, you know, that's a really bad news story that we paid for all these potatoes. So you can see that sort of driving the policy back into just these commodities that we can easily store and transport and that sort of thing. And so that carries over time. And then of course, the assistance reinforces that. So cotton farmers are getting assistance. They're telling their members of Congress to keep that assistance going, right? So the politics, again, have that aspect to it.
The assistance Jonathan mentions here is referring to the payments that are made to farmers as a form of subsidy to help farmers cope with fluctuating market prices. Originally, farmers received additional payments when they sold their corn at low prices to ensure a living wage. Now the system is based on average corn prices nationwide. If these prices drop below a threshold set by Congress, all participating farmers receive payments regardless of their individual sales. This system approximates potential income issues due to low prices, providing direct cash payments to keep farmers in business. It's important to note that these payments aren't linked to specific crops anymore in order to avoid influencing planting decisions. The goal of this assistance is ultimately to support farmers in managing high costs for equipment, seeds, fertilizer, and land.
I'll be honest, like I've spent a lot of time sitting with these programs. Where they've gotten to today is really hard to defend. These direct subsidy programs have gotten sort of removed or put at a distance from actual farm risk. What I think is probably the two most defensible things we do is around crop insurance. So we help subsidize the cost of buying an insurance policy on that crop. And then what we don't do enough of, but has real long-term benefits and really important, I think, for society is the conservation assistance. We're going to go out and help a farmer with the cost of putting in like a grass waterway that cuts down soil erosion and helps improve those things. And I think those investments actually don't get the priority they should get. Not to put opinions in this, but I do think we want to be careful. We do multiple things and some of these policies are better or more longer term effective than others. So the direct subsidies get a lot of attention. They're just one part of it. And certainly there is a strong set of arguments that those funds could be better invested, that they could be better invested, not just for the farmer's sake, but for the sake of the land, for the sake of our water, for the sake of our long-term, particularly with climate change, our long-term productive abilities. It's challenging to defend exactly how those things are set up. And that's why I think the history is important, because it helps to understand why we get locked into this type of policy. And it's difficult to make changes. Right. And we're seeing that in the current debates in Congress a little bit. You know, how much do we invest in conservation and can we use that for something else for these subsidy programs? And how do you define what the farmers' interests are? How do we prioritize these different policies and programs? And so I do want to, you know, not get us spread too thin on these topics, but subsidies are one component of it. They're the longest historic component. The way they've developed over time, particularly the last 30 or 40 years, makes it hard to defend them in this sort of public discussion, because research after research shows they're bigger and bigger, more sophisticated farmers with higher incomes, and they're getting large amounts of subsidies. And so I argue with people a lot on this that it's hard to defend them as they're designed, but there's certainly an argument rather than throwing that money away to reinvesting or repurposing or reprioritizing it towards the things we could all benefit more from. And I think a lot of that's in the conservation space. It isn't as if the only way to do this is subsidize farmers or we stop it altogether. I think that's a little bit too oversimplified. The challenge for somebody wanting to get into farming today, they're just immense. I mean, the hurdles are nearly insurmountable, particularly finding land. You know, the labor challenges, some of the vegetable and fruit production, the issues, they span the whole thing. And I do think that there is a really great argument and a really good policy discussion around, you know, could we use some of these dollars to invest in soil erosion reduction and water quality, invest in long-term resiliency for farming fields and farmers and young farmers getting started. I think there's a huge conversation that often gets blocked out because we focus in on these one set of programs to this one group of farmers. But look, that is itself a lesson in politics, right? That is a lesson in policymaking and the factional challenges of writing legislation that has to make it through an increasingly challenged Congress.
I think people understand the Farm Bill as this, you know, omnibus legislation that's a battle every 5 years and it's not being passed and we don't respect farmers anymore. There's just a lot of triggers. So where do we go from here?
That is the big question. Where do we go from here? The honest answer is I don't have an answer to that. One of the things I have been wrestling with a bit, and that is this sort of lack of innovation and this sort of struggle to evolve with these evolving issues around production. So the conservation, the climate change, the natural resource questions, the increasing risk issues. You know, our crop insurance program, for example, uses a 10-year history of yields. Well, that may or may not hold with extreme weather. And so I think the where we go from here question is trying to look ahead for that set of challenges, particularly in the risk category, like better understanding farm risk. I think we have to take into account the lessons we can pull out of the histories of this. You know, why we got to this point, how we got to this point, understanding those political dynamics in the history of this, I would argue is important because it is not reality to say, well, we're just going to change these things. We took 90 years to get here. We're not going to just upend that immediately. I found this interesting just historical episode around what was called the Soil Bank in 1956. And I love this story because it speaks volumes about this, right? And this was a farmer-driven idea. It actually came out of Illinois. A group of farmers said, look, we were in a time of surplus post-World War II. It's the early years of this technological advancement where we're mechanizing, you know, synthetic fertilizers, synthetic pesticides, herbicides coming out of the war. Those sort of technologies like are catching up to us, right? We're planting and producing so much and we're surplus commodities. And so there's a group of farmers in Illinois that are like, why don't we pay farmers to do this soil bank idea?
The Soil Bank program, introduced in the 1950s under the Eisenhower administration, was part of the Agricultural Act of 1956. It aimed to reduce agricultural surpluses and stabilize crop prices by paying farmers to remove land from production and plant soil-enriching cover crops, or to leave it fallow. Key components included the Conservation Reserve, which focused on soil conservation, and the Acreage Reserve, which reduced overall crop output. The program sought to prevent soil erosion, improve soil health, and promote sustainable farming. That was eventually replaced. It influenced future agricultural and conservation policies in the United States.
Instead of, you know, redirecting or overproducing crops, let's try, they didn't say it this way, but the way we would frame it now, let's make conservation practices and restoring soil health and those sort of things a priority. And that's what we should be subsidizing. And, you know, in a couple of years, they push it all the way up. It goes through American Farm Bureau to President Eisenhower. And in January of 56, Eisenhower says, this is my priority for a farm bill, the soil bank. And he pushes Congress to do it. And it is a knockdown, drag out political fight with Southern Democratic members in the Congress from the South who didn't like the idea. And he pushes, they had to veto the farm bill. He's up for re-election in 56. You know, the politics are swirling around this. And there's a great set of stories in there. And Congress does what it wants to do. And he vetoes it and sends it back, says, nope, that's not what I want. This is what I said to do. And they shift gears and they pass the soil bank. Now, unfortunately, they pass it too late for that planting year. And so the program gets off to a really bad start. And then some of the members from the South in Congress that start attacking it in the appropriations and cutting its funding. A couple years later, Eisenhower basically gives up. And so there's this blip, right? And some of these ideas take another 30 years until 1985 to get back in. And it's what we call the Conservation Reserve Program today. The idea that we pay farmers to retire highly erodible fields and get them out of production and we'll rent them from you for 10 years. That started in 56, but this whole political fight, right, throws the policy discussion off in this other direction, and we actually lose decades of potential conservation investments and evolution and policy improvements to where today, you know, it took until 85 to kind of get back to it. which meant the 70s, where we expand acreage and plant fence row to fence row mindset, and farmers go deep into debt and then fall off the cliff into the 80s, and we have an economic crisis. Like, all of these things may have been served better by a policy direction that we didn't take in that late 50s timeframe. And so what lessons should we be taking from that? How do we think about that now as we kind of sit at another potential pivot point around climate change and soil erosion and water quality issues? And we look back on that and think, okay, here's where we got off track. Look, we're never reaching a perfect policy. We're merely in the process of trying to perfect these things. And there's really nothing wrong with that. It's fine. We just have to get to work at it. And it isn't that all or nothing proposition.
So when we're looking back at history, we're seeing places where we went wrong, where we could pull some things out of history to sort of make some changes.
Or we can look back at it and reevaluate. And this is one of the great things about a farm bill. Every 5 years, we have a chance to revisit this. We're not locked in. We can look at this and say, okay, let's change course, which we did in 2014. We changed course fairly significantly in 2014. I think it does offer that opportunity to reconsider it. I think that's valuable.
In 2014, there was a major shift in subsidy programs for farmers. Starting in 1996, direct payments were made to some farmers annually, regardless of market conditions, amounting to about $5 billion a year. These payments became politically indefensible, especially post 2008 recession, when farmers' incomes were at record highs amidst budget and spending concerns. Consequently, the subsidy system was revised, replacing direct payments with two contingent policies based on low prices or low revenue, which farmers could choose from. This change, although not drastic, was significant and driven by the need to reassess and improve policies that were no longer effective. Understanding this from the general zeitgeist, but also from what you wrote about people's appetite for public assistance, for people who need support in terms of being able to afford food to eat and to feed their families. And that is coupled with subsidies for farmers. So there's the direct assistance to farmers through insurance help or direct subsidies. And then there's also support for families and individuals who can't afford to buy food. And yeah. So that's taken some, I think, political heat.
Oh, it's taken an immense amount of political heat. My personal opinion is that it is a very unfortunate political discussion, and I think it's counterproductive in many ways. The reality of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program is exactly what you said. Low-income people, low-income Americans and their families struggling to put food on the table. And this is a small amount of federal assistance to the individual or the family. Like, they don't get a lot of money. These are not lucrative payments. This is not a real cushy sort of assistance program. But the problem with it is that we have more than 40 million Americans in this country who fall below that poverty level and need help. The real thing that shocks me is it's like we skip right over that reality. And what we end up hearing is, oh, we're spending too much money. It's $120 billion a year. Yes, that is a huge amount of money to spend. But if all you see is that bottom line number, you're missing the fact that even at a time of record low unemployment, there are a lot of people working one or two jobs and still can't make ends meet. That's the problem. Right? It's not that the federal program costs too much. The problem is we have too many people who are struggling. And why is that? And so it's a great example of the multiple ways in which this program helps people and helps in the food system. I mean, I got kids, like when they get hungry, that's a difficult stretch of time. And my kids don't struggle that way, right? And so imagining those challenges at the family level, this helps. But we really lose a lot of the nuance and complexity around that when we fight about, oh, we're spending too much money on this. And look, it was in the mid-60s when we first paired these up a little bit. And it was largely because the farm support programs had lost political support. And they needed allies. And so they had to build a coalition through this food assistance. And so it's really counterproductive to attack this. The people that do this tend to have a very narrow view. It's rather destructive. And again, we get wrapped up in that large amount of funding. And we're not asking, why are 40 million families struggling to put food on the table? How do we address that? We could shrink the SNAP program spending if people were making more money in their lives and jobs. That's one of those issues that I've found to be very difficult historically to look through some of the ugliness that surrounded that. You know, if you're a farmer and you're in the business of producing food, whether that's food to an animal that's eventually going to be eaten, there's no value to you in people not being able to afford to put food on table. Like, it does you no good. These are your customers ultimately down the food chain. There's no political value and there's no value to your farming operation. And there's certainly a negative value to the community that you live in, that we all live in, the country we all share. So to me, that's one of the worst aspects of these farm bill debates in recent years, is that we've really allowed this issue to become such a political weapon, I guess, that it has threatened to really destroy the entire undertaking. And I don't think anybody comes out better on the other end of that one.
I have never met a farmer, talked to a farmer ever who didn't want to feed someone who was hungry, ever. I did speak with this interesting farmer in Indiana. He's a mid-sized farm, 6,000 acres, and he converted basically from all pesticides, all chemical inputs into his soil, into organic inputs. And here is the rub for me. $800 an acre to put in chemical fertilizer and herbicides, pesticides, et cetera. He went to cover crops, $80 an acre. I just don't understand why that doesn't speak louder.
There is no easy answer to that. And I also think that it isn't the situation that you have to be all one or the other. You don't have to switch to non-GMO, pure organic farming to do a better job of protecting soil and knocking down erosion and those sorts of things. I think there's a false choice in that I think is counterproductive to making progress. I would say farmers are great innovators. What we should be doing as much as possible is supporting that innovation. And if they want to innovate to go capture a special market in non-GMO soybeans, then the policy should never stand in the way of that. At the same time, it should be encouraging these sort of better practices on all the farms. The idea being, look, if that demand is there, then we should help farmers compete for it and meet that demand, not hinder those sort of innovations and development. These are costly things. They're putting a lot of costs in the ground. And if you think of it in terms of, you make a decision that you live with through the growing year, you can't reverse it, right? So if you're wrong about the weather, the organic thing isn't working this year, like, you may be out of business from that decision. So that's where I think we need to be thinking about our policies in terms of that risk and helping them innovate and adapt, and which we don't do. Our system right now is not set up to do that well, and that's a challenge. I think there's a lot to it that, again, I would rather see us discuss those complexities and nuances and try to work on policy solutions that help versus getting stuck in this way's bad, this way's good. And I know that's not what you're saying, but I do hear it a lot of times in that way. I think there's a more productive conversation, and I think we can make progress on some of these issues without, you know, the sort of vast kind of dichotomy between one this way or that way.
Like you said, those decisions on, you know, corn, wheat, and cotton were political decisions because those farmers, those interests were represented in Congress. And we don't have as many farmers there anymore. And yet still, we're talking about national security. We're talking about feeding people. Who wants to listen to farmers if farmers aren't there in Congress? Are we sitting down with farmers from a policy standpoint and asking, hey, we want to listen to your trial and error. We want to hear what's worked and what hasn't and how what you're doing could work for more farmers, how it could help with climate change.
I had the great privilege of working in Congress and the Senate on two farm bills. And I can tell you that staff and members, they were out field hearings and meetings with farmers and farm interests. I think there are times they could hear from more and more diverse voices in this and get more perspectives. That's not always easy, but they do. I do think that most of them, most of the time, put a good faith effort into hearing directly from farmers and trying to understand it. But again, if you think about the history of this, a lot of what we see today with the synthetic fertilizers and chemicals, again, that's been a development coming out of World War II. Some of the herbicides are the product of wartime innovations. And so the history of this is how our policies have helped push farmers in this direction. we got to take responsibility for what we do. But at the same time, the farmers are competing in a pretty tough, competitive set of markets. And so they've always tried to maximize what they can do in their fields and farms. And we've seen a lot of this industry shape to that direction. So much of the changes in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s, right? We're living with that now. And if you think about the average age of a lot of the farmers in the big commercial operations, you know, my dad got started in the early 70s, right? So there's a generation that inherited that and has sort of done that kind of farming. So how does it look for the next generation? Now, there's a lot of fascinating questions. I hang on to some optimism that we talk about those more in our deliberations over policy.
So what are three key things that the everyday people who are listening to this podcast need to look out for and to think about and maybe even to do?
I will plead the cause and the case, accepting and working in the nuance and complexity of these issues. That includes the history around it. Inform yourself, which is why I applaud what you're doing. Like, go out and learn and get informed about these issues so that you can be an effective messenger to whomever that might be. We're dealing in the food system, but we're also wrestling with environmental challenges, natural resources, the climate change, you know, water and soil. I think these policy discussions would benefit from more people being more engaged with that reality and working on the complexities and nuances around these kinds of challenges. I don't think farmers have any interest in soil erosion or losing nutrients to water. So then we've got to work on that as a policy. And again, these are public policies using public dollars. So we all have an interest. We all have a vested interest in that, both from the dollar side to the benefits or what comes out of it. So I think that part of it's critical. And then get involved. Talk to members, talk to Congress, to staff, to stakeholder groups, like find ways of getting involved and understand that at best, these are evolutionary. We're working on trying to evolve policies. We're not going to see like these revolutionary drastic changes. And so don't get discouraged. Don't give up on that. It is a constant work in progress. You know, we're perfecting these things. That's a lesson from history. That's a lesson from reality, but it's there and it matters. And again, I applaud anybody who's taking some time to wrestle with these issues and to think about it, because it's about the most fundamental things we have, food and water. And so it is extraordinarily important. And I just encourage people to care about it, to think about it. It's one of the challenges we've had with a lot of this sort of dwindling population in farming and rural areas is we're very disconnected from this, most of us. And that's not a net positive. That creates challenges. And so finding ways to get connected. I love what I see with farmers markets and some our local food producers and vegetable community supported agricultural operations. Go out and find some of that. You want to talk about some just inspirational stories of the work and time and effort they put into it. You think farming's easy, go volunteer to work in some of those fields every now and then, particularly in July and August around here. You know, that's a lot of work. And so get involved and find that. Go look for some local farm opportunities, the farmers market, support those operations and learn about what they do and think about how you want to see your public policies in that space.
In today's episode of One Bite is Everything, we had the privilege of speaking with Jonathan Kappas, associate professor focused on agricultural law at the University of Illinois. Jonathan provided us with a comprehensive overview of the Farm Bill, tracing its origins back to the New Deal and highlighting its significant evolution over the past 90 years. We discussed the critical role the Farm Bill plays in supporting farmers, ensuring food security, and addressing national security concerns. Jonathan also shed light on the ongoing debates in Congress regarding the current Farm Bill, emphasizing the challenges of adapting agricultural policies to the pressing issues of climate change, soil erosion, and sustainable farming practices. Key takeaways from our conversation include the historical context and importance of the Farm Bill, the complex political dynamics that shape agricultural policy, the need for innovation and adaptation in farming to meet the challenges posed by climate change. Jonathan's insights have provided us with a deeper understanding of how agricultural policy impacts our food, our health, the environment, communities that we live in, and our economy. Thank you for joining me today on this enlightening episode of One Bite is Everything. I hope Jonathan Kappas's experience has given you a clearer picture of the intricacies of agricultural policy and its profound effects on our daily lives. Remember, the choices we make about our food can drive significant change. To stay informed and take action, you can consider supporting local farmers and sustainable agriculture initiatives, engaging with your representatives about agricultural policies and their importance, staying educated on the impacts of climate change on farming and food systems. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe to the One Bite is Everything podcast, leave a review, and share it with your friends and family. Your support helps us continue to bring you important conversations that connect the dots between our food choices and the broader impacts on health, the environment, and society. For more information and resources, visit our website at www.forfarmersmovement.com and follow me on social media at XOXOFarmGirl. See you next time as we continue to explore how tiny informed choices can have a big impact. Until then, stay curious, get informed, and remember, one bite is everything.
Hear that? That's what cooked when you order Juicy Beef sounds like. The steaming hug of two slices of melted cheese, the crunch of tangy pickles and sliced onions, all topped with a toasted sesame seed bun. That's the sound of a McDonald's Quarter Pounder with cheese.
Fresh beef at participating U.S. McDonald's. Excludes Alaska, Hawaii, and U.S. territories.